So before we get into the tabernacle, which we'll do in a few minutes, we're going to do just a little bit of interpretation for Revelation, so we kind of can understand some of the pictures. One of the things you want to know is whenever it says in the NIV, "and I saw" or "then I saw," that means it's a new vision. It's always exactly the same phrase in Greek. I do not know why the NIV feels it necessary to have variety. "Then I saw," "and I saw." It's Kai Iden, "and I saw." And that tells you, oops, this is a new vision. All right. Now, we're in the middle of one here. So 12 does not start with "and I saw." It's part of another one. But let's look at it. See how good we are at interpreting. "A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven." Where is heaven? What is heaven?
It's a place where God dwells.
It's in the sky. You have to understand that most of the time in Revelation, when it says appeared in the heaven, that means he's looking at it from the point of view of the earth, but he is seeing this in the sky. Okay, so what does he see? "A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head." What are the sun and moon? Are
night and day.
The two great lights that rule the day and night, right. "She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his head." 7 is the number of the covenant. It is the number of the Holy Scriptures. And of course, who is the red dragon? It's Satan, right. So he is imitating the church with these sevens. "His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth." Fractions mean that he's powerful, but not all powerful. Sometimes it's a quarter, but most of the time it's a third. "The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days." Okay. Who's the woman? Answer, no.
The church.
Yes. Okay. Yes. It is not.
Oh, last time we studied it.
It is not who?
It's not Mary.
Right. Because she has a crown with 12 stars. That's one sign. And the other is that after Jesus is snatched up, she's protected by the Lord. Well, that's for 1,260 days, which is the period of time till the return of Jesus. It's not Mary. It's the church. And Jesus is snatched up. That's ascension. Now, it didn't happen the moment he was born, but we're not in the life of Jesus here. We're in the life of the whole world. And in the life of the whole world, he was snatched up. So Satan lost. He was going to devour her. Think of trying to kill the child and so forth. All right? "And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan," so there's no doubt who the serpent is, "who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth and his angels with him." And then there's this song of, and when it says there was a loud voice, that's a song. That's not a shout, it's a song. But let's skip the song for now. Verse 13, "When the dragon saw that he had been hurled to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child." Well, Satan never pursued Mary, you know, but he's after the church. The woman was given the two wings of a great eagle so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the desert. Desert means the set apart place where you can be safe. Where she would be taken care of for a time, times, and half a time. What's the Arabic number for time, times, and half a time? Time is?
Three and a half?
No, yes. Right. Time is
one.
Times is
two.
And half a time. Three and a half. That's the same as 1,260 days. 3.5 years. It is the time. Out of the serpent's reach. Then from his mouth the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. So Satan is going to do his best, but it's not going to work. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring. So again, I mean, he's not warring against the brothers and sisters of Jesus, except that we are the brothers and sisters of Jesus, but not by blood. Those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Well, then the dragon stands on the shore of the sea, and there's a beast out of the sea and a beast out of the earth that come. The beast out of the sea represents earthly power, because Rome, the power at that time, the earthly power at that time, was a sea power. You may not realize that from high school. Rome was, we always think of the Appian Way and the other via, the roads that Rome built, and they did build roads, but Rome was a sea power. That's how it projected its power. And so the beast out of the sea represents the enemies of Christians, believers who wield physical power and threat. And the beast out of the earth is those who represent a philosophical or a threat, you know, a theological or philosophical way of thinking, thought threatening rather than physical threatening. Okay, well, there's just one section. So it's dramatic, but a few things will make things plain. And what do you see in this? Better look out, boy. Red dragons, beasts out of the sea, beasts out of the earth. It is not going to be easy. But in the end, the church is protected. See? All right. Let's learn about Jesus in Exodus 25. Which begins offerings for the tabernacle. All right. Let's do some broad thinking. God creates human beings. He wants them to be in His image, like Himself. He's going to give them, He does, He gives them dominion over everything that moves on the earth. They're very powerful creatures, but they have free will. Now, you can ask, why did God create human beings with free will? But the Bible never deals with that question, so you can think about it, but you're not going to get anywhere. He did. Like so many things in the scripture that remain something that only God can tell us, a mystery has to be revealed. All right. So they fall into sin and ruin creation. God tries to rescue the world, the people, but there's two major failings. What marks the first major failing of God to reach out to the whole world? Got to think of the whole story of the Bible. Well, he fails with Adam and Eve, but he tries to bring everyone back and fails. And the thing that marks that failure is the
flood.
And then after the flood, he tries again to get everyone to follow the right way, and that ends disastrously in the Tower of Babel. So then God says, this is not going to work. So he calls one person. Now, I don't know what God did. All I have is the description in the scripture of what he did. If I'm talking about why he did something, that's my opinion. But that he did those things is no doubt. So now he narrows it down to one person and calls
Abraham.
And says, the woman's seed that was promised to Adam and Eve is going to be born through you. But I'm going to make you into a great nation. I'm going to give you this land that I'm calling you to go, and the child will be born. But to make sure that Abraham wouldn't have any confusion about how this is going to work, what does God do? Well, none of the promises can be fulfilled until what happens?
Until he has an heir.
Yes. And so God calls him at 75 and waits 25 years. It was already too late, and he waits 25 years. Abraham tried everything. Okay, well, we can get carried away in the details of the story. But now it's a family. And the family goes through Isaac and Jacob. Jacob is a representative of the crankiness and orneriness of God's people. His name means the tripper, the conniver. And he has favorites, Joseph is his favorite, and then Benjamin is his favorite, and he just causes all kinds of problems, but God loved him, and changed his name to Israel, which is better than tripper, but still is he who struggles with God. Jacob's sons grow up where?
In
Canaan. Will later become Israel, but in Canaan. And they don't do well with the Canaanites. There are several stories in the book of Genesis that tell us that they were not doing well. They were getting sucked in. So God says, okay, we're going to Egypt. And through Joseph, that gets there. And then they're there for 400 years, and then God raises up Moses. Well, now we're almost to where we are. Okay, now God says to Moses, I've fulfilled my promise to Abraham to make of you a great nation. I still have to get you to the promised land, and the woman's seed is yet to be born, but we're underway. And so in this, among these people, God needs to be with them and lead them. But what's the problem? What's the problem with God being with us?
Well, he's holy and we're sinful.
Yes. You can't be in the presence of a holy God. If you are going to stand before the judgment seat of Jesus on Judgment Day, you're going to be on the right or the left. And if you're on the left, you're not going to be there long. Sin does not stand in God's presence. So you better be dressed in a white robe. How are you doing with your white robe? You could answer that in different ways. If it's me and my white robe, it isn't looking so good. If the white robe, Genesis, Revelation chapter 7, those dressed in white robes, mm-hmm. made them white in the blood of the Lamb, well, then you can stand. Well, the blood of the Lamb, all right? We're getting to this. So God says to his people, I need to be among you. But I can't come with my holiness. Look at the Mount Sinai. The people said to Moses, will you go up there? No, because this is not working out, you know. So what does God do? Moses is up on the mountain, and God gives him a plan to build this portable way for God to be among his people. What is God's relationship to the universe? He is the what of the universe?
Maker.
Yeah, the maker, right. But now, what is he?
Keeper?
Yeah, he's the keeper. Ruler. What's the old word for ruler?
King.
Oh. He's the king of the universe, the ruler. You were right. You were right. Kings have what, Ed? Where they sit?
On thrones.
On thrones. And when we see a vision of God in the scriptures, both the Old Testament and the New Testament, he's sitting on the throne. So the idea of an earthly king was a picture of God. Now, I don't know, earthly kings don't match up to God, but it's a picture. So God tells Moses, make me a throne. We call it?
Church.
Oh, no. What is God's throne? It's right there.
The mercy seat?
Yeah, that's part of it. What's the whole thing called? The mercy seat is the cover. The Ark of the Covenant. Covenant is God's relationship with his people. The number of the covenant, Ray? What's the number of the covenant? You know that one? Is that sure? Okay. Ed, what's the number of the covenant?
Three.
No, that's the number of God.
Seven.
Seven. Four is the number for the earth, four corners of the earth. Three is the number for God. Three and four together are the covenant, the connection between God and man. All right. So there, God said, make this throne, but you can't, and put cherubim on it, because God dwells between the cherubim. Cherub is a Hebrew word, and the plural is cherubim. One cherub, one seraph, one cherub, cherubim, seraphim, all right? And that's where I'll be. But no one can come into the Holy of Holies. See, first there's this. If you were a child of Israel, you could, on certain occasions, come through that gate. But mostly not. But there were regular people of Israel did in their lifetime go in here. Only priests went into the tent of meeting, where you meet God each day, morning and evening sacrifices, and only the high priest went into the Holy of Holies, and only once a year after elaborate preparations. That's Leviticus 16, the Day of Atonement. So what is God saying to the children of Israel? I wish to be among you, but I have to be separated from you, because my glory, my perfect holiness and righteousness will destroy you. So God says, build this portable building, because you're on your way to the promised land, and I will go with you. So God sets up a system that incorporates the main way for God and man to become one. That started in the Garden of Eden. That is by what? What's the only thing that can bring God and man together?
A mediator.
Someone has to do it, but
The shedding of blood,
because the wages of sin is death. That is an immutable fact. The wages of sin is death. Somebody has to die. And because Adam and Eve were naked, so they solved it with fig leaves. God solved it by killing animals. And so the thin red line of the Old Testament begins. And the individual people, Noah, Abraham, Cain, well, not Cain, Abel, Adam, Abel, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the children of Israel, and now we have a whole people, and God says, they all have to be able to bring a sacrifice. So here's how we're going to do it. Here's how we're going to make a connection between a holy God and sinful people. But the sacrifices only looked forward to Jesus Christ. Killing an animal doesn't take your sin away. It simply points you to the fact that God is going to do this in the future. So Everybody understood what John meant, the baptizer, when he pointed to Jesus and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." Not just your sin, but the sin of the world. Well, that, okay. Now we're a long ways away from Jesus Christ, but we're beginning to see him. So God says, build this building. The side walls, I don't know how much detail you can see, were put together by boards. It's about 45 feet long, 15 feet high. See, this one is shown with a peaked roof here, and this one is shown with a flat roof, and we just don't know what it is, which it is. But these boards were put together by having rings on them that boards went through. The inside of this building was covered with gold. The Ark of the Covenant had figures of cherubim on it. They were solid gold. The box held the Ten Commandments. Why? Because it was the Ark or box of the
covenant.
And the two tables of stone represented the Lord's copy and the people's copy of the covenant that God made with his people. He committed himself to them. He promised them certain things if they would do it, but the basic covenant between God and human beings was one-sided. It did not require something from us. But God said to the children of Israel, if you keep all the commands and decrees that I give you, then your sheep will have lambs, your wives will have children, you'll defeat your enemies, and all kinds of good things will happen. But the rain will fall, you know, everything, but they didn't believe it. And never took God, or almost never took him at his word. So this building could be taken apart. So the children of Israel could see the Ark of the Covenant when it was open, but then God was not dwelling between the cherubim at that point. When they moved, they would set the Ark of the Covenant down and they would build the tabernacle over it from the outside. And once that was built, then no one went in. Nadab and Abihu, Aaron's sons, decided that they were going to be the successors to their father, who's getting older now, and they were big muckety-mucks, and so they decided that they were going to bring some incense to the Lord. They got right here, and the moment they moved the curtain aside, they died right on the spot. And Aaron was very upset, and God said, suck it up. Not interested in comforting you. You need to learn to listen. This is what happens when you don't listen. Whoa. So Aaron just needed to pick up where he was, and the third son ultimately succeeded. All right, now, every day, the children of Israel, the priests, the tribe of Levi has all the priests in it, plus the other people in the tribe of Levi are the assistants who run this. This is the center of Jewish life. Later on, under Solomon and successors, the taxes were collected through the temple. The whole economic life of the children of Israel revolved around the temple. Unfortunately, Solomon's temple was ultimately destroyed, and the temple that Herod built that was there in Jesus' day had no Ark of the Covenant in it. The Holy of Holies was empty. But that was God's judgment. God had decided that. But see, God was saying, I want to be among my people. That's the way he was with them in the old covenant. What's the way he is with them in the new covenant? What's the temple of the new covenant?
Word and sacrament.
Christ.
Jesus. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again. And some might have thought he was talking about the temple, Herod's temple, but he was talking about himself. What's the veil? See, there was the veil right here with the... What's on the veil, by the way? Can you see that? What's on the veil? Cherubim, whose wings stretch across. Genesis 3, when they left the garden, when God drove them out, he put cherubim to guard the way to the tree of life. Now, it doesn't say in the scripture that those cherubim were on there, but they're guarding the way to the Lord. Adam and Eve could not return. There was no way that they could. Only God can accomplish that. So every day, every morning and every evening, the priests brought sacrifices. The individual people brought peace or fellowship offerings that they brought. Half would stay for the priests and the Levites, and half they would take home. And they came from all over Israel to the tabernacle, later to the temple, to make those sacrifices. So they would be camped out in the hills around Jerusalem. Jesus, think of Jesus going with his Father. What a moving thing that must have been for him to realize that that those sacrifices represented him. I mean, what's the correct word? Types of himself, or forerunners of himself, and the sacrifice that he would make. And he learned that as he came to understand what the sacrifices were about. The sacrifices that the priests brought in the morning and in the evening were burned up on the altar of burnt offering. But most sacrifices were not burned up. The overwhelming number of sacrifices were
eaten.
Yeah. You eat sacrifices. That's so on the Day of Atonement, the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies. He wears completely different clothing. See, there's a representation of the priest's regular clothing, which is very colorful. But on the Day of Atonement, he wore only white, and he only wore it on that day. And he went in with blood to sprinkle on the mercy seat, the throne of God, to cleanse it of the sin of the people. You know, because God is dwelling among his people, it's corrupting God's throne. God's temple needs to be cleansed of the sins of the people, just like the cosmos, the universe, needs to be cleansed of the sin of God's people. And Jesus, when he died on the cross, entered into the Holy of Holies in heaven, and with his blood took away the sins of all humankind that have corrupted God's creation. So all of this is going on. Now, there's a great deal in the Day of Atonement. All the details have great significance and meaning, but there's two goats. One is killed as a sin offering. The other one is the scapegoat, right? Priest puts his hands on the head of the goat and recites the Ten Commandments, the sins of the people, and this goat is taken out into the wilderness and left to die. All right. So, yes.
This is probably a dumb question.
There's no dumb questions.
Did God ever appear in the temple? You know, like
yes,
the burning bush and the... Yeah, he did. So those priests, when they went in there, they actually...
Well, the priests, plural, only went into the tent of meeting. The high priest went in. And when he went in, he took coals, burning coals from the... this altar of burnt offering, they're not burnt offering, altar of incense, as he went in, put two hands full of incense onto those burning coals so that the room was completely filled with smoke, right. And in fact, his eyes would have been burning, he just would have been going through the motions. Later on, Jewish tradition yeah, tradition's a good word, but not in the scripture, but Jewish tradition has it that when the high priest went into the temple, Solomon's temple, he had a sash tied around his ankle, because the high priest served until death, or until he was disabled. So lots of the high priests, your son would then take over, but your son might be 60 years old by the time he becomes the high priest. So the high priests tend to be older people. Well, okay, they're going to go in, the pressure is on, pulse is pounding, blood pressure goes up, heart attack or stroke. Well, who's going in to get them? You know, so hey, we don't know if that's true, but that tradition is there. You guys ever see the law? I'm not going in there, you know, because Nadab and Abihu didn't even make it through the outside door, you know. So those are interesting things. But now God is going to set up for his people a way for him to be among them. Well, Jesus is that temple. Now, there are no more sacrifices. How would you explain to a 7-year-old why you were killing a lamb? Or a goat, for that matter, anything? That 7-year-old would say, well, why are we killing this lamb if Jesus died on the cross? No. So sacrifices are over. But God still works in ways in which he comes to us, not requiring us to go to him, because we have no clue. How would the children of Israel in all their tents, or, you know, they're just represented by making rows of tents there. But the people are there. Are they all going to get together and figure out how to get to God? Don't have a clue, any more of a clue than we have. But God comes to us. For them, he came in sacrifices and in the temple and the Ark of the Covenant. For us, he comes in word and sacrament. But he comes the way he chooses to come, not the way we choose to do it. So when Nadab and Abihu decided that they were going to kind of invent the worship, we'll try this out, boom, that's all over. You do it the way God tells you to do it. Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. Nothing has changed from the Old Testament to the New Testament in the fundamental relationship between God and sinners. So one day, with our robes washed white in the blood of the Lamb, we will be before God. And when that day comes, here are some of the descriptions of those people. They are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. Well, the children of Israel didn't do that. The priests did that. And he who sits on the throne will spread his tent, that's tabernacle, over them. Never again will they hunger, never again will they thirst. Sun will not beat upon them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Revelation 7. So, the tabernacle is very important. The children of Israel didn't do a particularly good job of sticking with the things that God commanded. And at varying times, there were reformations, there were high points. What is the high point of the Old Testament history for the children of Israel? Represented by whom?
King David.
David. And God grants him victory over his enemies, and finally the promised land reaches its full potential, where it was supposed to be, but only briefly. And it's downhill after that. And what we see in the Old Testament is God tries everything. Everything that you can possibly think of, and nothing works. The only thing that will succeed is for God himself to come and redeem his people. The woman's seed will crush Satan's head and turn this victory around, or turn his Satan's victory into defeat. But only the woman's seed can do that. And that's what Jesus was doing. So when we're reading the Gospels in the New Testament, if we don't understand where he's going, then you can't understand things. The disciples had difficulty with that. The Pharisees and the Sadducees when they saw Jesus feed the 5,000 and the 4,000, they said to him, "Well, give us a sign from heaven and we'll believe." And Jesus said, "You won't get any sign except the sign of Jonah, 3 days in the grave, you know. But this wicked and adulterous generation, idolatry and adultery are the same thing. See, you're unfaithful to God." And then they go from there, after the feeding of the 4,000, they get in the boat and they go across. And they did the same thing in feeding 5,000. But in the feeding of the 4,000, Matthew tells us that the disciples only had one loaf of bread with them. And so Jesus, as they're going across, he's teaching them, and he says, you have to learn to avoid the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who won't believe that Jesus is the Messiah. So they're having a big discussion among themselves about, was he, you know, leavened? Does he know we only got one loaf, that we forgot to bring bread? And he says, you dolts, you know, I'm not talking about bread, I'm talking about the unbelief. You know, well, Jesus had to put up with that. He puts up with us. Just always remember, whenever you're reading and you think, how could the people be that dumb? If you can't understand how they could be that dumb, one of two things is happening. Either you aren't understanding the situation and therefore can't see how it applies to you. So we don't really know what it was like in those days, and we're not getting that. Or we're simply not applying it to ourselves, which we like to do, you know. It's you know, whenever you're looking down on the Old Testament people in particular, or Peter, you know, Peter, come on, Peter, geez, you know. His little girl is, little servant girl is, you're one of them. Oh, I've heard of the guy. You know, and you think, how could he do something like that? Well, if you're really thinking that, you aren't understanding your own situation, or Peter's, or both. All right. So let's take a look at chapter 25 and see a little bit of the things that go into this. Offerings for the temple. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to bring me an offering. You are to receive the offering for me from each man whose heart prompts him to give." So this is a free will offering. It's over and above the tithes. These are the offerings you are to receive from them: gold, silver, and bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn. Those were the colors of the tabernacle: blue, deep red, scarlet red, and purple. And fine linen, goat hair, that's what we would call angora, ram skins dyed red, and hides of sea cows. Now that one, you know, there's a little, they're guessing dugongs. The truth is, that's a Hebrew word, and we're just not really sure what animal that refers to. But the hides of, there's an animal like, a dugong-type animal in the Red Sea, whose hide is highly prized for leather. So it could very well be that that's the correct guess. We need acacia wood. Acacia wood is very hard. God chose acacia wood because if you'd made it out of pine in 1400 and we got to David, that'd be 400 years. A pine ark would not look like much in 400 years in that dry desert. But acacia wood is dense and hard. olive oil for the light. So there's a light in the temple that's very important. Spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense. The formulas or the recipes for making the incense and the anointing oils that were used in the temple ceremonies were unique. You never made that mixture of things for ordinary living. The onyx stones and other gems to be mounted on the ephod. The breastplate is a hard cover. The ephod is that little square of color. It's hard to see. You can look up there. Then have them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them, a holy place. Make this tabernacle and all its furnishings exactly like the pattern I will show you. So Moses saw a model of this, so that he knew how. God gave him the dimensions, but exactly how it was to look. That's why we don't know whether it had a kind of peaked roof like this drawing or a flat roof like this one, because we don't have any 3D description or measurements. We have width and length, two dimensions. Okay, now let's begin to look at the things. The main thing that was in it was the ark. Excuse me. The ark is essentially a box. It was 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. That's about 3.75 feet long and 2.25 feet wide. So kind of square, not especially long and narrow. It had rings on it, and you could put poles through it, but it was covered with gold inside and out. And here it comes. And the mercy seat, the cover, was solid gold. The angels, it had a wooden cover, but that wooden cover was covered with gold. Won't do any good. And the angels were solid gold. What exactly they looked like, again, Moses had this pattern, model. So he knew what it ought to look like. But he didn't, there isn't any description except that their wings spread upward and overshadowed the ark, the mercy seat. Keep your finger here and turn to Isaiah. After Psalms, you can find Isaiah. We want Isaiah chapter 6. It's getting warm, isn't it? Yeah, let's move a little bit here. God appears to Isaiah. God appeared in various ways, but the scripture makes clear that no one ever saw God. Who was the one who came closest to him? Moses. Remember, Moses says to God, I want to see you. So God says, okay, puts him in the cleft of the rock, covers him as God passes by, and Moses sees the trailing parts of God's glory. That's all he could have taken. All right, but now in Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah tells us, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne. See, so the Ark of the Covenant is a representation of heaven. High and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Now see, the Solomon's temple is there in Isaiah's day. Above him were seraphs, a cherubim here, but seraphs, each with 6 wings. With 2 wings they covered their faces, with 2 they covered their feet, and with 2 they were flying. So they're covering themselves because of the glory of the Lord, with 4 of the wings of the 6 wings, and with two they're flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy." The number of God?
Three.
The whole earth is full of his glory. At the sound of their voice, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. This is like the Day of Atonement. The doorposts of the temple, those temple doors were gigantic. They were huge metal doors. And so for them to shake, that's the people who, in Isaiah's day and Isaiah himself, who went to the temple and saw the temple, thought, well, if the doors shake, whoa, and it's filled with smoke like on the Day of Atonement, what does Isaiah say? Woe to me. I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. He didn't, but he saw a representation of the Lord, and that was too much for him. Then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand from the incense altar, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, "See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." Touching his lips, because Isaiah's job was to be a prophet. He's going to speak God's word, right? Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I, send me." And he said, "Go and tell this people," and then it's law and gospel. So won't read all of that. All right. That's the heavenly temple. Let's go back to Exodus 25. And there we have the ark. Now, in addition to the ark, that's very important, but we can only do so many things, all right? There was a table. Now, the ark is the only thing that is in the Holy of Holies. Oh, by the way, there are different names. It has to do with the Old Testament being translated into Greek in the Septuagint, and then from Greek translated. In the Old Testament, the outer room is called the Tent of Meeting, or the Tabernacle of the Congregation. Tabernacle is a tent. Congregate is meet. Tabernacle of the Congregation and Tent of Meeting are the same thing. And the holy place is where the Ark of the Covenant is. In the New Testament, in Hebrews, you sometimes have the Tent of Meeting called the Holy Place, and the place where the Ark of the Covenant is called the Holy of Holies. But it's not different, it's just different terms. Now, nothing is in the Holy of Holies or the Holy Place, but there are varying furnishings in the Tent of Meeting, where the priests go in every morning and every night. So, verse 23 of chapter 25, "Make a table of acacia wood, 2 cubits long." See, 2 cubits is about 2.25 feet. No, that's 2.5. Two cubits would be more than that.
36.
About 3 feet.
3 feet.
Okay, right. So, it's 3 feet long, a cubit wide, so about 18 inches wide, and a cubit and a half high. So it has legs. "Overlay it with pure gold and make a gold molding around it." Probably means an edge, a raised edge. And then it's described, it has rings so that you can put a pole through it and carry it. That's what the Levites did. They picked everything up. When the Shekinah, the pillar of cloud and fire, moved, the Levites all got up and they took the coverings off. They took the walls apart piece by piece, and the whole tribe of Israel carried these pieces. You know, 4 men to a 15-foot long pole that was covered with silver or gold. I mean, these things were enormously heavy. And they would cart them off, and then they would set it down and build it up again. But once it was built, no one went in it. This table was there because the children of Israel were instructed to place a loaf of bread for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And it was an honor, by the way, to bake them. And those were replaced. But different people in the tribes. If it was your family that was going to provide the bread, the show bread it was called, for the tribe of Reuben or Benjamin or Judah, whatever it was, they would pick that by lot, and your mother would be very excited that she would get to bake that bread. Because that might happen, there's so many people that might happen once in your life, might not happen at all, that you would have that opportunity. Some of the children of Israel got to provide the two rams for the burnt offering on the Day of Atonement, the bull for the sin offering for Aaron and the Levites, and the two goats for this the sin offering. One was the sin offering, one's the scapegoat. If you got to provide those animals, then tradition has it that you could be inside this outer curtain or wall. That could be taken apart too. The whole thing is portable. And the pieces like the altar, you can see the posts through them. They pick those things right up. The altar of burnt offering did not have a bottom. So you set it on the ground and then built a fire in it to burn up the animals. Well, it'll go away. All right. Also inside of the tent of meeting is the lampstand. This does not burn candles. It burns, it had wicks, and it burned olive oil. And it did not look like a menorah, you know, the symbol of Israel, because it was made out of metal, and the various arms of it, there were seven lamps. It was a lampstand, it had seven lamps, or oil-burning lamps. But it was metal, and in the metal arms was carved or formed a channel so that the supply of oil in the middle would flow down. And that lampstand burned all the time. So you can imagine that by the time we get from the days of Moses in 1400 approximately to the days of David in 1000, think of all the smoke on the inside of this, you know. So David's building his palace, and he says, well, I have this beautiful palace that I'm building, and God's in this tabernacle that's 400 years old. It's beginning to fall apart. But David was not permitted to build the temple, but he gathered much of the materials, especially the precious metal. The temple that Solomon built would have cost billions today. It was a huge building, and the inside of it was literally covered with gold, not gold leaf, with gold. And when we read Kings and Chronicles, we discover that the children of Israel kept paying off their enemies because they wouldn't trust in the Lord. They would have won, but can't trust in the Lord. Got to have an army, and they would get beaten, or they would make a treaty with Babylon against Egypt, or Egypt against Babylon, or whatever. And they always had to pay off these people, and they were gradually stripping the temple of all of the precious metal that David and Solomon had put in it. Okay, let's talk about the tabernacle. Well, here, I think the tabernacle is important. Let's read it. Verse chapter 26. Make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of finely twisted linen and blue, purple, and scarlet yarn. So these 10 curtains hung around the inside. And with blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, they were to work into them cherubim by skilled craftsmen. All the curtains are to be the same size, 28 cubits long and 4 cubits wide. Join 5 of the curtains together and do the same with the other 5. Make loops of blue material along the edge of the end curtain in one set and do the same with the end curtain in the other set. Make 50 loops on one curtain and 50 loops on the curtain end curtain of the other set with the loops opposite each other. Then make 50 gold clasps and use them to fasten the curtains together so that the tabernacle is a unit. These are the ones that, the various covers that go over the top. Now, there are other things that go. And they could, all the clasps would go in the rings, and that's how they put it together. Make curtains of goat hair for the tent over the tabernacle, 11 altogether. All 11 curtains are the same size, 30 cubits long and 4 cubits wide. And then it talks about how they are joined together. Let's go to verse 15. Make upright frames of acacia wood for the tabernacle. Each frame is to be 10 cubits long and a cubit and a half wide, with 2 projections set parallel to each other. These are the pieces here. See, with the rings that go through. Make 20 frames for the south side of the tabernacle and make 40 silver bases to go under them, 2 bases for each frame. So they're a cubit and a half wide, so they have a base, 2 bases, so they would be solid. For the other side, the north side, make 20 frames, 40 silver bases. 6 frames for the far end, that's the west end of the tabernacle, and make 2 frames for the corners at the far end. At these 2 corners, they must be double from the bottom all the way to the top and fitted with a single ring. Both shall be like that. Now, what that means is that the corner ones were doubled so that when they stood this up, it wouldn't be shaky. It would be solid. Also make crossbars. That's across the ceiling of acacia wood. 5 for the frames on one side of the tabernacle, 5 for those on the other side. I won't read all of those details. Excuse me. Set up the tabernacle according to the plan shown you on the mountain. See, that's why we can't be exactly clear what it looked like. Make a curtain of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and finely twisted linen. The finely twisted linen is the fabric. And the blue and the scarlet and the purple are the yarn that was used to make the forms of the cherubim.
Like embroidery?
Like embroidery, right. And with cherubim worked into it by a skilled craftsman. Hang it with gold hooks on 4 posts of acacia wood. Verse 33, hang the curtain from the clasp and place the Ark of the Testimony behind the curtain. The curtain will separate the holy place from the most holy place. Now that's yet another term. Got the tent of meeting and the holy place. Now here the holy place and the most holy place. But you can see most holy place and holy of holies, it's the same thing. Put the atonement cover on the Ark of the Testimony in the most holy place. Place the table outside the curtain on the north side of the tabernacle and put the lampstand opposite it on the south side. So if you look in there, there's the south side over there, here's the north side, there's the table right there. Now then is described the altar of burnt offering. That's the large thing out here with kind of the smoke going out of it there. There was fire in that all the time that the tabernacle was in one place and was being used. So that's another thing that the Levites did. They kept that fire going. They tended the oil in the lamps. Young Samuel, who was dedicated to the Lord's service by his mother, helped the priest take care of the oil for the lampstand. That altar has four corners, and it talks about the horns. And so if you look very carefully, it's got like horns, but we really, maybe that just meant the corners, but a horn, it's the word for a horn. So you know, it's described how well Moses knew what it was supposed to look like. All right, then is described the courtyard. And all of these are posts that are, they only show them with supports on one side, but they had supports on both sides that were stakes driven into the ground and held it. And then, of course, they had poles in between. And all of this was covered, at the very least, with bronze, which was expensive and difficult to make, but much of it gold and silver. Then it talks about the oil for the lampstand. So they're kept burning. Aaron and his sons, verse 21 of 28:7. Aaron and his sons are to keep the lamps burning before the Lord from evening till morning. This is to be a lasting ordinance among the Israelites for the generations to come. And they didn't put them out in the morning. They burned during the day, but they were to burn all night long. So 24 hours. Then are described the priestly garments. Look at verse 4 of chapter 28. These are the garments they are to make. A breast piece that went around the top. An ephod... A robe, that would be the whole garment. The tunic would be tied around the front and would go down the back. And then a turban to wrap his head so nothing is visible of him except his face. And a sash that's tied around the robe. They are to make these sacred garments for your brother Aaron and his sons, so they may serve me as priests. Have them use gold and blue, purple and scarlet yarn and fine linen. So all of the clasps and so forth apparently were gold. And then this fine linen, again with these same colors. Let's look at the ephod. Make the ephod. This is this thing that hangs down. It is to have two shoulder pieces attached to two of its corners so it can be fastened. So in some way it went over his shoulders and was held in front of him. Verse 9, take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel in the order of their birth. Six names on one stone and the remaining six on the other. Engrave the names of the sons of Israel on the two stones the way a gem cutter engraves a seal, then mount the stones in gold filigree settings. And it's kind of hard to figure this out because it would be very difficult. Are there two stones or are there a series of precious stones? I think it's two. You certainly can't have onyx. You could find onyx stones that would be big enough to engrave the names of the sons. So the priest, whenever he goes into the holy place, wears the ephod with the names of the 12 tribes of Israel on it. He represents them. Middle chapters of Hebrews, all of the Levitical priesthood is described and how it's fulfilled in Jesus. So this is, in addition, now I don't think that's right here, is it? Okay. Here's the, let's look at the breast piece. Fashion a breast piece for making decisions. Now, this is what caught, what held the Urim and the Thummim. And again, we're not exactly clear what this is and what it looked like, but it was what the children of Israel could do was to come to the priests and they could get answers to questions, but they only got what answers, Ed? If you consult the Urim and the Thummim, then you can only get...
Yes or no.
Yes or no, right. So you had to frame the question as a yes or no question, and then the Lord would answer the question. The problem for the children of Israel, though, is the Lord didn't always answer the question the way they wanted it answered, so they stopped asking. It's like Ahab. Ahab says... get me another prophet. I don't like what this prophet is telling me, you know. That's what she's, how stubborn we can be. God would have guided the children of Israel. But let's learn about the breast piece here. Fashion a breast piece for making decisions, the work of a skilled craftsman. Make it like the ephod, of gold and of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, and of finely twisted linen. So this went over the top of the ephod. It is to be square, a span long and a span wide. And that's like 9 inches. So it wasn't huge. But, you know, 9 inches would just fit in the middle of the priest's chest. Yes?
Do we know why God insisted on blue, purple, and scarlet? Those colors? Those three colors?
Not really. You can guess. Blue, perhaps heaven. Scarlet, blood. Purple?
Royal.
Well, yeah. I mean, but they're all guesses.
Yeah, they are guesses.
You know,
a combination of blue and red.
Yeah, well, you can. Well, yeah, but it's three different words. It's not a combination. It's blue, purple, and scarlet yarn.
But I mean, purple is a combination.
I know it is. Yeah, but there were three. That the words are separate. Yeah. Jeez. Okay. All right. Well, let's see what it is to be square and folded double. Then mount four rows of precious stones on it. In the first row, there will be a ruby, a topaz, and a beryl. In the second row, a turquoise, sapphire, and an emerald. Third row, a jacinth, an agate, and an amethyst. And in the fourth row, a chrysolite, an onyx, and a jasper. Now, some of those words are also guesses. We are not absolutely sure that those English words are exactly what the stones were. But in the end, it doesn't make any difference. They have to make a little bit of guesses. Mount them in gold filigree settings. Filigree, well, ladies, you know what filigree? Does anybody know what filigree is? It's the fine pattern kind of work that would make a setting.
Yeah.
So a goldsmith is making this.
It's sort of a woven thing, isn't it?
Well, it can be, but filigree means fancy.
Like a door leaf?
Well, yeah, but that's in fabric. This
right,
is
it would be like that.
Yeah.
In gold.
Well, it's a pattern, whatever it is. You know, it's a fancy setting. Make it in a filigree setting, a fancy setting. there are to be 12 stones, one for each of the names of the tribe of Israel, each engraved like a seal with the name of one of the 12 tribes. So each, like a seal, it represents that tribe. For the breast piece, make braided chains of pure gold like a rope. Make two gold rings for it and fasten them to the two corners of the breast piece. Fasten the two gold chains to the rings at the corner of the breast piece and the other ends of the chains to the two settings. Attaching them to the shoulder pieces of the ephod. So it talked about the settings that were on the ephod. And so it's all attached. But again, it's very difficult to figure this out exactly. But Moses saw it. Yeah. So make two gold rings and attach them to the other two corners of the breast piece on the inside edge next to the ephod. Make two more gold rings and attach them to the bottom of the shoulder pieces at the front of the ephod, close to the seam, just above the waistband. So it's held down, top and bottom. The rings of the breast piece are to be tied to the rings of the ephod with blue cord connecting it to the waistband so that the breast piece will not swing out from the ephod. So it isn't to be hanging there, it's to be attached to him. Whenever Aaron enters the holy place, he will bear the names of the sons of Israel over his heart on the breast piece of decision as a continuing memorial before the Lord. Also, put the Urim and the Thummim in the breast piece. And boy, would we love to know what the Urim and the Thummim are. But they are the two choices. And remember that it was folded over? So there's all kinds of speculation. Some people think that they were exactly alike in terms of shape, but were colored differently. But we don't even know what they were, so that's a guess. But at any rate, when they asked the question, then the priest would reach inside of the breast piece, which was folded over and attached with these rings. He'd put his hand in there, and he would maybe move these two pieces apart, and he would pull one out. And whatever it is, that was the answer. But there's nothing to describe this. I mean, exactly. So that's a pretty good guess. Thus Aaron will always bear the means of making decisions for the Israelites over his heart before the Lord. Well, what does that mean? What does that represent? The means for making decisions. Where are the decisions for the children of Israel going to be made?
From God.
Yeah.
This gave him a yes or no of whether they should.
But where? To the obvious thing.
At God's throne.
But at the tabernacle.
Yeah.
I mean, he only went into the Holy of Holies once a year. So, you see, God is going to rule his people. He did not want to have a king. He told Moses, though, that the children of Israel would ultimately want a king and that he should grant their wish. That God will grant their wish in the future, not Moses, because it was much later. It was in the days of Samuel. But otherwise, the priest, you wanted to know what you were supposed to do. He came to the temple and you got an answer. God was ruling his people. So that was the means for making. Now, there were other priestly garments, the tunic, the sashes, and the headbands. And now it talks about the high priest garments. That's what we have been talking about. But it also describes garments for just the priests. Then in chapter 29, let's start in verse 42 of chapter 28. Make linen undergarments as a covering for the body, reaching from the waist to the thigh. Who takes off on that?
Mormons.
You heard about Mormon underwear? See, the men are all part of the priesthood. So they wear this underwear from the thigh to the waist.
Isn't the whole tabernacle idea kind of like the Mormons?
Sort of.
Only go so far depending on what your status is.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
They've also got the Urim and Thummim, don't they?
Who?
The Mormons. They consult. Yeah, they do.
They do? Mm-hmm. Could very well be. I didn't hear that. You mean like in Salt Lake?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. I wouldn't doubt it. Their view of the Old Testament is bizarre. I mean, those who really have studied this and understand that, and then go through, we went through the temple up here when it was open. Yeah, they don't have a clue. But they just have this phony guy who comes up with these gold tablets. Oh man, what a joke!
Trying to sell that somebody.
Yeah, Joseph Smith, and what there were five witnesses. I can't remember, and of course they never. Well, the Book of Mormon tells of this vast, huge civilization that was created by the people who came over to the New World, and then after Jesus rose from the dead, he came over and appeared to them over here. And if you get to the temple grounds, you can see a big presentation of that. But this huge civilization with roads and bridges, as it's described in the Book of Mormon, and all these buildings and so forth, disappeared without a trace. Spurlos in German, spurlos versenkt. Gone without a trace. And when I was young, Mormons would go on archaeological digs. But they would find something and they would suggest, well, this is part of it. Then real archaeologists would go in and say, well, it's Aztec or Inca or Mayan. And they would find things from their temples and so forth that obviously weren't Mormon. They don't do any archaeology anymore. That's something you can tweak Mormon missionaries with that, but you can't shake them. You know, are they doing any more archaeological expeditions to find all the cities of the Book of Mormon? The vast civilization just completely disappeared without a trace. On the other hand, archaeologists regularly study the Bible to figure out where to go and find the ruins, you know, because it's history. The Book of Mormon is a fairy tale. That's as simple as that. An invention by, most people think that Joseph Smith didn't really, that somebody else wrote it. I can't remember why they think that. He might have written it. But at any rate, it's just this fantastic story written in King James type language.
It was written 2,000 years ago in King James English.
Yeah, right. Well, it was written in ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, and of course it was translated into King James English, so that wouldn't bother them. All right. But now let's, in 29, the priests are now consecrated. You have to have go-betweens. People can't simply come. Now, the go-betweens are not any different than the regular people, except that they're chosen by God and set apart. But, I mean, they're not holy people. They were just members of the tribe of Levi. And so, but you can't come directly into the presence of God. And so these priests are never in the end going to do, because their duty is never done, is it? They just keep right on going. But then the high priest comes, who of course is Christ, and he brings the Levitical priesthood to an end. So chapter 29 is the consecration of the priests. And after that is done, now the priests are ready to function. The altar of incense comes. This is right here, right in front of the cherubim on the veil that separated the Holy of Holies from the holy place. So that's described in chapter 30. Look at the atonement money. Then the Lord said to Moses, when you take a census of the Israelites to count them, each one must pay the Lord a ransom for his life at the time he is counted. Then no plague will come on them when you number them. See, God did not like numbering.
Yeah, why is that?
Well, because he didn't want the children of Israel to find their strength in their numbers. So numbering was done only very carefully, and if they pay then to be redeemed, it's atonement money. Each one who crosses over to those already counted, is to give a half shekel according to the sanctuary shekel, which weighs 20 gerahs. This half shekel is an offering to the Lord. All who cross over, those 20 years old or more, are to give an offering to the Lord. So you're on one side, and you go over and you put your... And that continued. Jesus was watching the people bring their offerings to the Lord. That was the continuation of this idea. And the widow doite have any, she puts in a mite. The rich are not to give more than half shekel, and the poor are not to give less. When you make the offering to the Lord to atone means at one, to buy back. Receive the atonement money from the Israelites and use it for the service of the tent of meeting. It will be a memorial for the Israelites before the Lord, making atonement for your lives. And then the next one, this is where we'll stop, is the basin for washing right here. The priests are constantly washing themselves, and washings in general were part of the laws that God made for the children of Israel. If you touched something that was unclean, then you had to wash yourself. That's why John was called the baptizer, because people didn't, he washed them. He was the, that was different, completely different than what happened before. Okay, let's pause at this point. Bezalel and Oholiab are the people who were in charge of the work. And then in chapter 32, that's where we'll start the sad tale of the golden calf that just jumped right out of the fire, Aaron said. It was just amazing. Excuse me. Oh, boy. Okay. All right, well, I think what we should be able to finish. We will. We'll finish Exodus next time. And we'll do that by picking out the things that are most important and keep on going. Okay.
Is next week our last?
Next time?
Yeah.
And we are having one last. Last time I was here, you guys were having a discussion and conversation.
Yes.
Yeah, we're coming back. We're coming back on Wednesday. Rachel's here now.